what I will say next, of course, you already know, and that is, let's go ahead and do it. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. And this is Parsha Naso, so you know that's going to be one of the very first words. Turns out it's the very first word we're going to see in the book of Numbers, or Bamidbar, in the wilderness, chapter 4, verse 21. And it says, after the part where Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, here come the words in red, take the sum, naso et rosh, or rendered more literally, lift up the head, do a head count, of the sons of Gershon also, by their fathers' houses, by their families. Going to count this time those from 30 years up until age 50. Number them. And all that enter in to wait upon the service, to do the service in the tent of meeting. Now, this, it says, is the service of the families of the Gershonites in serving and in the bearing of the burdens. You shall bear the curtains, or they're the ones that will bear the curtains of the Mishkan, of the tent of meeting, all of its coverings, the sealskin that's above it, the screen for the door, the tent of meeting, the hangings of the court, the screens by the door of the gate, by the tabernacle, the altar round about, all the cords, instruments of their service, anything that pertains to those. This is how they will serve. At the commandment of Aaron and his sons shall be all the service of the sons of the Gershonites. So basically what it says is, this is the pecking order, or the order of command. It's going to be Aaron that's going to call the shots, and the Gershonites will be at his service. In all their burden, you will appoint unto them the charge of their burden. This then is the service of the families of the sons of Gershon, the Gershonites, in the tent of meeting. Their charge. And now we get the direct charge under the hand of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest, or the Kohen. As for the sons of Merari, another one of the sons of Levi, you'll number them by their families, their father's houses, again, from age 30 up to 50. Number them, everyone that enters upon the service, to do the work of the tent of meeting. Now here's their burden, according to their service in the Mishkan, the boards of the tabernacle, the bars, the pillars, the sockets. So basically the structural elements, all the pillars of the court round about, their sockets, pins, cords, even all the things that appertain to them, and everything associated with their service. By name, you shall appoint the instruments of the charge of their burden. So everybody's going to know what it is that they're going to move. This is the service of the families of the sons of Merari, according to all their service in the Mishkan, under the hand of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. Now, Moshe and Aaron and the princes of the congregation then numbered the sons of the Kohathites by their families and father's houses. Again, age 30 to 50, everyone that did the service in the tent of meeting. Those that were numbered, okay, here we're going to get the counts, were 2,750. These are they that were numbered of the Kohathites and their families, all that served in the Mishkan, the tent of meeting, who Moshe and Aaron numbered according to the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. And then those that were numbered, the sons of Gershon, by their families and father's houses, again, age 30 to 50, all those that did the service, those that were numbered were 2,630. These are they that were numbered of the families of the sons of Gershon, all that served in the tent of meeting, whom Moshe and Aaron numbered, according, again, to the commandment of Yahuwah. Those that were numbered of the sons of Merari by their families and father's houses, age 30 to 50, everyone that did the service, those that were numbered by their families were 3,200. These are they that were numbered of the families of the sons of Merari, whom Moshe and Aaron numbered, according to the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. Now we're going to get the combos, right? All those that were numbered of the Levites, the three families combined, whom Moshe and Aaron and the princes of Israel numbered by their families and father's houses, 30 to 50 years old, all that did the work of the service, bearing the burdens of the tent of meeting, those that were numbered in total, 8,580. And according to the commandment of Yahuwah, they were appointed by the hand of Moshe, everyone to his service and to his burden. They also were numbered as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. Now, chapter 5 is kind of an interesting one. We're going to see a number of things in here that are, I guess you'd say, prophetic in one sense or another. They certainly have a lot to do with things that we're going to see throughout this time frame that's coming up now, this time of Shavuot, I think, in particular, and things that are associated with the spring feast. So, starting with this, command the children of Israel and say that they're to shalak, send out of the camp, everyone who is a metzora, who has zara'at, send them outside the camp. And anyone who is unclean that has an issue or that is unclean by the dead. So it's not just those that we have already talked about that have that particular ailment. There are other things, various kinds of issues. And by that, I mean an issue that, you know, something that flows from their bodies, or they have been in contact with a dead body, so they're unclean. Both male and female you put outside the camp, so that they do not defile the camp, because, it says, in the midst thereof where I dwell. And the B'nai Israel did so. They put them outside the camp, as Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, so the children of Israel did. So Moshe then, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, speak in turn unto the B'nai Israel. And when a man or a woman commits any sin that men commit, and it's a trespass against Yahuwah, and that soul is guilty. So this trespass here is le'moel. I guess it's limol, a trespass, and they're guilty. Then they shall confess their sin that they've done, make restitution, so they make it right, and for that guilt, they then add to it, right, a fifth part, 20% more, and they give it unto the person with respect to whom he has been guilty. In other words, the one that was stolen from or that basically was damaged by their act. And as Rashi puts it, the one to whom he owes the silver, the one who was wronged. Now, if the man doesn't have any kinsmen to whom restitution may be made for that guilt, restitution for guilt shall belong to Yahuwah. And then in turn, it'll be the Kohens, besides the ram of the atonement, whereby atonement shall be made for him. So, if there is no next of kin, then it goes to the Kohenim. Every heave offering of all the set apart holy things, kadosh things, that the children of Israel present unto the Kohen, that shall be his. Every man's hallowed thing shall be his. Whatsoever any man gives the Kohen, that is his. Now, then we're going to get to another interesting section. This is one of those that I think is particularly fascinating and apropos. Maybe not too surprising. It does tend to be overlooked a lot as well, which makes it even more pertinent, especially today. By the way, this section sometimes is given a name, and it's referred to by the name of the individual. Although this word doesn't actually appear, I don't think it appears in the portion at all as a noun. It's just a description. And the description of this person, this woman, is called the Sota. The woman whose husband thinks, has reason to believe, or maybe he's just got a spirit of jealousy, but he thinks she may have committed adultery. So the Sota. If any man's wife goes astray, goes aside, and acts unfaithfully against him, it begins, and here's what the words in red are saying, and a man has lain with her carnally, somebody has slept with her, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband. He doesn't know it, but maybe he suspects. And she has been defiled secretly. There's no witness against her, nor has she been taken in the act. So, nope, there's no way of knowing for 100% sure. But if a spirit of jealousy then comes upon the man, and he is jealous of his wife, and she is defiled, or he could be wrong. What if the spirit of jealousy comes upon him? He's jealous of his wife, but she is not defiled. Well, how's he going to know? Answer. That's what this process is about here. And The following is what's going to happen. The man shall bring his wife unto the Kohen, and he brings an offering for her. The offering is a tenth part of an ephah of barley meal. He pours no oil upon it, nor frankincense. It is a meal offering of jealousy. And, of course, the word here is kinah, or a keynote, in this case, plural. A meal offering of memorial, bringing Torahlessness, iniquity, trespass. To remember, so it's worse than trespass. This is actually an act of something which is, as we see elsewhere, adultery is worthy of death. The Kohen shall bring her near. He sets her before Yahuwah. Now, as we go through here, I want to pay special attention to the process, because what's interesting to me is that this process and things that seem to describe to varying degrees, but usually reasonably closely, this process appear a number of places in Scripture. That's what's fascinating about it. It's not just that it has a function here, but it's kind of prophetic. So the priest brings her near. He sets her before Yahuwah. And he then takes holy water in an earthen vessel. So presumably, this set-apart water is the ashes, the water from the ashes of the red heifer. It's in an earthen vessel. And he takes of the dust that is on the floor of the Mishkan, or later the tabernacle. He takes all of that. He puts it in the water. So he literally bends down, he gets this dirt, and he puts it in the water. The Kohen then sets the woman before Yahuwah, and he lets the hair of her head go loose. So if you think about it, I guess metaphorically we could say he removes her hair covering. He removes the covering from her head. And isn't that kind of what's happened here anyway? Her covering has been removed in the form of her husband. Then he puts this meal offering of memorial in her hands, which is the meal offering of jealousy. The priest then shall have in his hand that water of bitterness, it says, that causes the curse. So he takes this cup, this earthen vessel, he puts it, he has it in his hand. Now, then he causes her to swear. And he says to the woman the following, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone aside to uncleanness, being under your husband, you are now free. Be thou free from this water of bitterness that causes the curse. So, if no harm, no foul. But on the other hand, if you have gone aside, being under your husband, and that word is tachat, interestingly, and if she is defiled, and some other man besides your husband has lain with you, then the Kohen will cause the woman to swear the oath of cursing. And he shall say unto the woman, Yahuwah make thee a curse and an oath among your people. That when Yahuwah does make your thigh fall away and your belly to swell, that this water that causes the curse will go into your bowels, make your belly swell and your thigh to fall away. Or sometimes it's rendered as literally your thigh to rot. The woman shall say, Amen, Amen. Now the curse, the priest, the Kohen, then writes those curses on a scroll. Writes the curses on a scroll. And he blots them out with the water of bitterness. And then he makes a woman drink the water of bitterness that causes the curse, and that water, that maim, that causes the curse, shall enter into her and become bitter. The priest then takes the meal offering of jealousy out of the woman's hand. He waves that meal offering before Yahuwah, brings it under the altar, takes a handful of the meal offering, the memorial part thereof, makes it smoke upon the altar. And after all of this, he has the woman drink the water that causes the curse. When he's made her drink that water, well, it'll come to pass, one of two things. If she is defiled and has acted unfaithfully, if she has committed adultery, then the water that causes the curse will enter into her and become bitter, and her belly shall swell, and her thigh shall rot, fall away, and the woman shall be a curse among her people. Now, on the other hand, if the woman has not been defiled, but in fact is clean, she's innocent, then she shall be cleared, and she shall conceive seed. So a couple of things about this are kind of interesting. One, of course, is, I talk about it every year, and most folks that have heard this teaching are aware of it. But on the other hand, if you go through Scripture and look, you'll see that this is an action that is taken out in the Mishkan, the temple, by the Kohen, and it is said to be, and as far as I know, this is something you can check out, it is said to be the only such commandment, action, process, procedure in all of Torah that requires a miracle from Yah. Right? She's either guilty or she's not. She knows, and in fact, nobody else may even know except the Creator. And what happens depends on the truth of the matter. So the miracle is that the truth is revealed. And furthermore, it turns out that she is innocent. She literally shall conceive seed. If she's been barren up to this point, now she's no longer. This, it says, is the Torah of jealousy. When a wife, being under her husband, goes aside and is defiled. Or when the spirit of jealousy comes upon a man and he is jealous or concerned about his wife, then he shall set the woman before Yahuwah, and the priest shall execute upon her all of this Torah, Kol HaTorah, all of this instruction, this process. And the man, it says, he shall be guiltless. He is free from iniquity, and that woman shall bear her guilt, her own Torahlessness. And that, too, is unique. Later on in this very same book, Numbers chapter 30, we'll see what I have often called one of the most important understandings in the book when it comes to marriage and the authority that a husband and a father has over his wives and his daughters' vows. and how that is very key. And one of the key words in that that chapter there, of course, is that when he exercises this authority and he ends up casting down a vow, he shall bear her guilt. He bears her Torahlessness, her iniquity. This case, though, is in dramatic contrast to that. He's clear from guilt, and she bears the guilt in this case. Okay, next chapter says, and this one is another one of these items that I think is kind of interesting. It's also one that causes a lot of people's eyebrows to raise. Why is this in here? Although, I'll start by saying there are a couple other places that we'll see this. The first one looks like a very, very similar process at the incident with the golden calf. People have committed idolatry, spiritual adultery. What does Moshe do? He takes the golden calf itself. He grinds it into powder, and he mixes it with water, and he makes people to drink. And guess what happens? Well, we're not told explicitly what happens, but somehow or other the Levites that came and took their swords and went out and executed judgment were able to tell who needed dying and who didn't. And another miracle that was performed, I can't help but wonder, was it that their thigh rotted and their belly swelled, and that those people that were showing those symptoms, the Levites knew, needed to be dispatched? The other time, of course, we see this is with Yeshua in the Garden of Gethsemane, and where he has a cup. Now, the cup looks like the cup that they drank from the Passover Seder, or the Last Supper, as people have referred to it. But basically, very much like what is described in Scripture, I have no doubt. And after that, he asks, "Let this cup pass from me." And what cup are we talking about here? Well, arguably, I think it's pretty clear that this cup looks like the cup that is given to the wife that is suspected of adultery. Now, in this case, he's going to take the cup for the wife who everyone, at least he and his father both know, are guilty. And, of course, we know the famous ending to that story is, "No, not my will, but thy will be done." So, again, this is where I started to go when we were so rudely interrupted. The point of the Nazarite vow, of course, is that it is it's thought to be kind of an indication for the people who are of the laity that are not of the Kohanim. What would it be like, right? Give them some indication of at least a flavor, maybe is a good way to put it, of a priestly service and the kinds of things that they would go through. So they take a Nazarite vow for a certain period of time, and the process is described here. Now, interestingly, this is also the proof that Paul, Shaul, used when he was accused of things that we know, anybody that's been paying attention to his word knows, he did not do, which is he did not do away with the Torah. He did not contradict his master. He didn't say it's all done away with. He said basically that, no, it's not enough. You can't earn your salvation. And people then tend to do a really, I think, logically inane kind of thing and say, well, then we best not try. If I can't earn salvation, then why should I even be obedient to him? The hell with him and the horse he rode in on. You know, it's kind of a stupid twisting of what Paul said. The fact that you can't earn it, that it's a free gift, is great. Does not mean that it's not your reasonable service to walk in obedience to him. And one of the things that Paul used, of course, to make that point and to cast down that that bogus claim that he thought the law was done away with. And by the way, this was after Yeshua and the resurrection. Let me say that again. This was after the resurrection. So for those that say, he was the final sacrifice, that was all, they got to rationalize, what was Paul doing then making offerings that are associated with the Nazarite vow if the law was done away with after Yeshua had risen? Huh? The point is, something is wrong with their bogus twisting of Scripture. Doctrines of demons and so forth. And the Nazarite vow, therefore, is important. And let's go through it. So, still not in the Pal Talk room. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, "Speak unto the B'nai Israel, and say to them, when a man or a woman shall clearly utter a vow, in fact, the vow of a Nazarite, to consecrate himself unto Yahuwah, here is what he will do. He shall abstain from wine and strong drink." So not just fruit of the vine, but other strong alcoholic drinks as well, it sounds like. We emphasize specifically the grape. That seems to mean no grape preserves, no jelly, no jam, no grape juice, no nothing. Maybe no grape nuts either. Anyway, he shall drink no vinegar of wine, the vinegar of strong drink, nor shall he drink any liquor of grapes, nor eat fresh grapes or grind, no raisins either. All the days of his Nazariteship he shall eat nothing that is made of the grapevine, from the pressed grapes even to the grape stone. All the days of his vow of the Nazariteship no razor shall come upon his head, till the days be fulfilled in which he consecrates himself unto Yahuwah. He shall be kadosh, set apart. He'll let the locks of the hair of his head grow long. All the days that he consecrates himself unto Yahuwah, he shall not come near a dead body. So that part is similar to a Kohen as well. He is not to make himself unclean, not for his father or his mother or his brother or his sister when they die, because the consecration of Elohim is upon his head. All right, had a long break here. Apologies with a problem online, folks.
What I'm talking about here is chapter 6 of the book of Numbers and the Nazirite vow. And I'll just briefly recap, because it was quite a while I was gone, obviously, that this was something that Shaul or Paul used as well, after the time of Yeshua, after his resurrection even, in order to prove that it was a bunch of BS that the law was done away with, and that even some of the claims about sacrifices and so forth, they obviously have some kind of a problem with the doctrine, because Paul went ahead and did this. Must be a different kind of thing that was being talked about, huh? And that's, I guess, the point here. So the person who takes this Nazirite vow shall not shave his head, shall not shave his head until the day of his cleansing. And on the seventh day, then he shaves it. But let's pick it up. Let me back up just a second here. Okay, so all the days that he is consecrated unto Yahuwah, he does not come near a dead body, not make himself unclean for his father, his mother, his brother, any of his relatives of close nature like that, because his consecration to Elohim is upon his head. And all the days of his Nazirite vow, he is holy, set apart, kadosh unto Yahuwah. Somebody dies very suddenly beside him and defiles his consecrated head, then he shaves his head on the day of his cleansing, and on the seventh day he shaves it. On the eighth day, he brings two turtle doves, two young pigeons, to the priest at the door of the tent of meeting, and the priest prepares one for a chatat, a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, to make atonement for him, because he sinned, whether he did so deliberately or was beyond his control or not, by reason of the dead. And then he hallows his head that same day. He shall consecrate unto Yahuwah the days of his Nazariteship. He brings a he lamb of the first year for a guilt offering, but the former day shall be void, because his consecration was defiled. In other words, he starts over. And this is the Torah, the instruction about the Nazirite. When the days of his consecration, whatever it was that he set aside, are fulfilled, then he brings it under the door of the tent of meeting. He presents his offering to Yahuwah, one he lamb of the first year without blemish, for an olah, a burnt offering, one ewe lamb of the first year without blemish, for a chatat, and one ram without blemish for shalamim, for peace offerings. Basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil, and their meal offering and their drink offerings. The priest, the Kohen, shall bring them before Yahuwah and offer his chatat, his sin offering, and his olah, his burnt offering. He offers that ram for a sacrifice of shalamim unto Yahuwah, along with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest also offers the meal offering and the drink offering. And the Nazirite then shall shave his consecrated head at the door of the tent of meeting. He takes the hair of his consecrated head and put it on the fire, which is under the shalamim, the peace offerings. The priest then takes the shoulder of the ram when it's sodden, one unleavened cake of the basket, one unleavened wafer, puts them in the hands of the Nazirite after he's shaven his consecrated head, and the Kohen shall wave them for a wave offering before Yahuwah. This is kadosh for the Kohen, together with the breast of waving and the thigh of heaving. And after that, when all this is done, the Nazirite might again drink wine. This, it says in conclusion, is the Torah, the instruction of the Nazirite who takes his vow, and of his offering unto Yahuwah for his Nazirite-ship. In addition, but beside that, it says, for which his means suffice, according to the vow which he vows. So he must do after the instruction, the Torah, of his Nazirite-ship. So if you recall, back to the story in Paul, with Paul in Acts, these other folks didn't have enough money, evidently, to be able to do some of these things. So Paul helped out, and he paid for the sacrifices that were offered at the end of their Nazirite-ship. Okay, the next section, we're going to recognize this one. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, and say, on this way you shall bless the B'nai Israel, and you shall say to them, Yivarekaka Yahuwah Varishmareka, Yair Yahuwah Panavaleka V'chaneka, Yisa Yahuwah Panavaleka V'yasim Lecha Shalom. And in English, Yahuwah bless you and keep you. Yahuwah shall make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. Yahuwah lift his countenance upon you and give you shalom. And thus he says, they shall put Shemi, my name, on the B'nai Israel, and I myself shall bless them. Chapter 7. Now, this is another interesting chapter. This is the last chapter in the Torah portion. It is also, and I'm saying this from memory, but I'm pretty sure this is correct, it is also the longest chapter in the Torah. It's over 80 verses. 89 verses. And what's interesting about it, and some would say not so much interesting, I've heard it said, oh, this is boring. Well, one thing is for sure, it's repetitive. And as an engineer, this has always kind of spoken to me a bit, because when an engineer sees things that are repetitive, almost, but not exactly word for word, well, most of the words are identical, with the exception of things like the name of the individual and his house, which varies. But when you see those kind of things, you think, well, redundancy is kind of, it's interesting, because redundancy is one way that we can check for errors, and it tells us if things are correct. But there's a lot more to it than that, and that's what's kind of fascinating. I have always had a strong suspicion that in this set of offerings are some encoded messages, if you will, things that Torah has for us that are there that we may not even understand yet. And the fact that it's repetitive doesn't mean we shouldn't read it and try to at least understand. Let him speak to us through his word. Now, there is another element of this, too, and I've always thought this is kind of clear. But as we go through it, I'll make the point. So there is one other thing that, again, should kind of leap off the page at us. But here we go. Let's get into it, and we'll see where it gets repetitive somewhere into chapter 7. And it came to pass on the day that Moshe had made an end of setting up the Mishkan, the tabernacle. He'd anointed it, he'd sanctified it, all the furniture, the altar, the vessels, they're all ready to go. They're anointed and sanctified. That here come the princes of Israel, the heads of their father's houses, and they're going to make an offering. These were the princes of the tribes. These are they that were over those that were numbered, those that were attended to. Their heads were lifted up and counted. They brought their offering before Yahuwah. Now, they were all counted, but these were the heads of those. They brought their offering before Yahuwah. 6 covered wagons and 12 oxen. A wagon for every 2 of the princes, and for each one an ox, they presented them before the Mishkan. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, take it from them, that they may be able to do the service of the tent of meeting, the ohel of meeting, and give all of this to the Levites, to every man according to his service. So Moshe took the wagons and the oxen, he gave them to the Levites. 2 wagons, 4 oxen he gave unto the sons of Gershon for their service. 4 wagons and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the hand of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. But unto the sons of Kohath he didn't give any, because the service of the holy things belonged to them, and those things they bore on their shoulders. So they're going to carry them by hand on their shoulders. The princes brought the dedication offering of the altar in the day that it was anointed. Even the princes brought their offering before the altar. And Yahuwah said to Moshe, they shall present their offering, each prince on his day, for the dedication of the altar. So here we go. At this point, we're going to see, a little bit, actually a lot, 12 sets of repetition. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the first one, and then I'll go through the others in an abbreviated fashion with a bit of commentary on it, because this is, again, the longest chapter in the Torah. The first one, he that presented his offering, the very first day was Nachshon, the son of Aminadab of the tribe of Judah. His offering, here we go. His offering was one silver dish. The weight thereof was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, after the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour, mingled with oil for a meal offering, one golden pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one young bullock, one ram, one he lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, one male of the goats for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of Shalemim of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five he goats, five he lambs of the first year. This was the offering of Nachshon, the son of Amminadab. So that ends the first of the repetitive sections. Here we go. On the second day, Nathaniel, the son of Zuar, prince of Issachar, did offer. He presented for his offering, I want to guess, one silver dish, the weight thereof was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, after the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour, mingled with oil for a meal offering, one golden pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one young bullock, one ram, one he lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, one male of the goats for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of Shalemim peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five he goats, five he lambs of the first year. This was the offering of Nathaniel, the son of Zuar. On the third day, we come to Eliab, son of Helon, prince of the children of Zebulun. And guess what? His offering, one silver dish, the weight thereof 130 shekels, one silver basin, 70 shekels, after the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mingled with oil for a meal offering. All right, we get the picture. And the reason why I think this is interesting, I've read it twice. We already see the pattern, right? So why do we get it 10 more times? We see the pattern. What a modern author would do is say, well, the last 10 were just like the first two, or second verse, same as the first. Why? And I'm going to suggest that there are several reasons. Some of them are kind of obvious. I have no doubt that there are probably other reasons. I've mentioned the kind of nerdy engineering one that has to do with redundancy and things that are in the Torah that we might not even recognize. But I can't help but think that there are some probably other things as well in here. But one, the one that leaps off the page at you is, what is the single difference here? And it's repeated at the first and the last of each of these segments. It's the name of the individual, the prince, and of the tribe for which he is the patriarch. That is all that is different. Every single thing that they did, every single thing that they brought, identical. Even word for word, literally, character for character, identical to the smallest detail, except for those noted differences. And so what leaps off the page? Well, I guess one of the things is, even though all of these offerings were identical, each one of them was important, and each one of them was unique, in spite of the redundancy, in Yah's eyes, and in the eyes of all of the people who saw this. They were gonna go through this for 12 days and see it. So I find, think about that. The whole point of something being this redundant has got to should make a dramatic impression on us, and ought to ring true at some level. So I encourage folks, read through this. I try to read through it every year, even though you say, well, I've seen it many, many times, and yet, there is a reason. There is no idle word in Torah. That is the key here. What I'm going to do here is go through a few of the others, and I will skip over some of the parts that are redundant, but I want to make the point. On the third day, Eliab, son of Helon, prince of the children of Zebulun, his offering, right, we know it, one silver dish, the weight thereof 130 shekels, one silver basin, 70, and so forth. And at the end, this was the offering of Eliab, the son of Helon. On the fourth day, Elitzur, son of Shedeur, the prince of the children of Reuben. We know what his offering was. At the end, it says this was the offering of Elitzur, the son of Shedeur. On the fifth day, it is Shalumiel, the son of Zuri Shaddai, the prince of the children of Simeon. His offering? Yep. One silver dish, weight thereof, 130 shekels, one silver basin, and so forth. On the sixth day, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, the prince of the children of Gad, and we know what his offering was, the golden pan of 10 shekels, and one young bull, one ram, one he-lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, and so forth. On the seventh day, now notice this, seventh day, That would be the Sabbath. There's a Sabbath in here for sure somewhere. This is probably it. On the seventh day, Elishama, the son of Amihud, prince of the children of Ephraim. I guess it must be okay to bring an offering, doing good, doing a mitzvah on the Sabbath. Anyway, he brought his offering. And you know what it was? One silver dish, the weight there of 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, and all of the other items that are listed there. This, it says, was the offering of Elishama, son of Amihud. On the eighth day, Gamaliel, son of Pedazur, prince of the children of Manasseh, brought his offering. Yep. On the ninth day, Abidan, the son of Gideoni, prince of the children of Benjamin, brought his offering. And yes, again, we know what it was. The tenth day, Ahiezer, son of Amishaddai, the prince of the children of Dan, brought his offering. Yep, one silver dish, 130 shekels, one silver basin, 70 shekels. All of the he-goats, bullocks, rams. On the 11th day, Pagiel, the son of Ochron, prince of the children of Asher, brought his offering. And again, we know exactly, because it has been said before, we're going to get it one more time, what it was. And on the 12th day, Ahira, the son of Enan, prince of the children of Naphtali, his offering. Now, I'm going to read it one last time to kind of close this out, because at the end of this, the Torah portion ends, and is anything yet leaping off the page at us? His offering was one silver dish. The weight thereof was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, after the shekel of the sanctuary. Both of them full of fine flour mingled with oil for a meal offering. One golden pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one young bullock, one ram, one he lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, one male of the goats for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offering, shalamim, two oxen, five rams, five he goats, five he lambs of the first year. This was the offering of Ahira, the son of Enan. And with that, the redundant portion ends, and we get this summary. And no surprise here, one of the nice things about redundancy, right, from a nerdy engineer standpoint, we can check. We can add things up. We can cross-check. Was every section the same? We don't know that it's supposed to be, but if we know in hindsight that it was, then we can check and make sure that there's no errors in the text. How about this? We can also add up the things and see what the totals are. That gives us another indication that the text is correct, and furthermore, that what we're seeing here is consistent, and, well, if it's not, that too would be a message, right? So it ought to be. Here it says, this was the dedication offering of the altar in the day when it was anointed at the hands of the princes of Israel. 12 silver dishes, 12 silver basins, 12 golden pans. Each silver dish, right, we know it, weighing 130 shekels. Each basin, 70. All the silver of the vessels, 2,400 shekels after the shekel of the sanctuary. 12 golden pans full of incense, weighing 10 shekels apiece after the shekel of the sanctuary. All of the gold of the pans was 120 shekels. All the oxen for the burnt offering, 12 bullocks, the rams, 12, the he lambs of the first year, 12, and the meal offering, the males of the goats for a sin offering, 12, and all the oxen for the shalamim of peace offerings, sacrifice of peace offerings, 20 and 4 bullocks, 60 rams, 60 he goats, 60 he lambs of the first year. This was the dedication offering of the altar, and after that, it was anointed. And when Moshe went into the tent of meeting that he might speak with him, then he heard the voice, the coal, speaking to him from above the ark cover that was upon the ark of the testimony from between the two cherubim, and he spoke to him.